I looked at Edward and mouthed, "What's up?" The strangest part was that Donna knew them. I could tell by her face that she knew them and was scared of them. Could this day get any stranger? Chapter 13. Peter let out a soft,
"Oh my God."
His face showed fear. He put his angry, sullen look up like a mask, but I was close enough to see how wide his eyes were, how his breathing had quickened. I glanced at Becca, and she had curled back into the seat between Edward and Donna. She peered out around Edward's arm with wide eyes. Everyone knew what was happening except me. But I didn't have long to wait. The threatening threesome came right up to the booth. I tensed, ready to stand if Edward did, but he stayed seated though his hands were out of sight under the table. He probably had a gun out. I dropped my napkin accidentally on purpose, and when I came out from under the table, the napkin was in one hand, and the Browning high power was in the other. The gun was under the table out of sight, but it was pointed at the bad guys. From under the table, the shot probably wouldn't kill anyone, but it would make a big hole in someone's leg or groin, depending on how tall the person was who happened to be standing in the wrong place at the wrong time.
"Harold," Edward said, "you brought backup."
His voice was still Ted's voice, more lively than his usual, but it was no longer a pleasant voice. I couldn't have told you what had changed in the voice, but it raised the tension level another notch. Becca scooted back until she couldn't see the men, hiding her face against Edward's sleeve. Donna reached for her, drawing her away from Edward and into her open arms. Donna's face was openly fearful like the girl's. Edward's was open, almost smiling, but his eyes had gone empty, his real eyes peeking out. I'd seen monsters, real monsters, pale under that gaze. The short one with the scar shifted from foot to foot.
"Yeah, this is Russell," he motioned at the Indian. "And this is Newt."
I almost said, "Newt?" aloud, but figured we had enough problems without me being a smartass. And people say I don't know when to keep my mouth shut.
"Tom and Benny still in the hospital?"
Edward asked, voice still conversational. So far we hadn't attracted too much attention. We were getting some glances, but not much else, yet.
"We're not Tom and Benny," Russell said.
His voice matched the smile on his face, but I was reminded that smiling is just another way of baring teeth, another way to snarl. "Bully for you," I said. His gaze swiveled to me. His eyes were so black that the iris and pupil had melted into one black hole.
"You another psychic bleeding heart trying to keep the Indian land safe for us poor savages?"
I shook my head. I've been accused of a lot, but never of being a bleeding heart. I smiled up at him and thought that if I pulled the trigger, I would take out most of his thigh and maybe cripple him for life. He was standing that close to the table. Close enough that I wanted him to back up, but I was waiting on Edward, and he seemed just fine with them towering over us.
"You should leave now,"
Edward said, and his voice was beginning to sound like Edward. Ted was leaking away, leaving his face a blank, cold mask, his eyes empty as a winter sky. His voice was without inflection, as if he were saying something totally different. Edward was emerging from his Ted mask like a butterfly pulling free of a chrysalis, though I wanted something less pretty, less harmless for the analogy, because what was pulling free into the light wasn't harmless, and if things went wrong, it wasn't going to be pretty at all. Russell leaned over the table, large hands spread across the top. He leaned way over so he would be close to Donna's face, ignoring both Edward and me. Either he was stupid, or he figured we wouldn't draw first blood in a public place. He was right about me, but I wasn't so sure about Edward.
"You and your friends stay out of our way, or you are going to get hurt."
He wasn't smiling when he said it. His voice was flat and ugly.
"You've got a cute little girl there. Be a shame if something happened to her."
Donna paled and clutched Becca tighter. I don't know what Edward had planned because it was Peter who spoke.
"Don't you threaten my sister."
His voice was low and angry. No fear showed through. Russell's gaze flicked to Peter, and he leaned over into his face. Peter sat unmoving until their faces were inches apart, but his eyes flickered back and forth like they were trying to escape. His hands gripped the seat edge, as if he were literally holding on to keep from backing down.
"And what are you going to do about it, little man?"
"Ted?" I made it a question. Russell's eyes flicked to me, then back to Peter. He was enjoying the boy's fear and the show of bravado. Hard to be tough muscle if you can't make a 14-year-old boy back down. He'd finished scaring Peter, then turned to me. I don't think he considered me a threat. His mistake. I couldn't see Edward through Russell's bulk, but I heard his voice, cold and empty.
Do it.
No, I didn't shoot him. That wasn't what I'd asked permission to do, or what Edward had given the go-ahead on. How did I know this? I just did. I switched the gun to my left hand and let out a breath, long and soft, until my shoulders were relaxed. I centered myself like I learned for years in judo and now kenpo. I visualized my fingers going into his throat, through the flesh. When fighting for real, you don't visualize hitting someone. You visualize throwing the punch through them and out the other side. Though I would hold back a little. You can collapse a man's windpipe with this move, and I didn't want to go to jail over this. I dropped my right hand down to the seat beside me and brought my hand up with two fingers like a spear pointed. Russell saw the movement but didn't react in time. I drove my fingers into his throat, coming to my feet with the strength of the blow. He gagged, hands going to his throat, half collapsing on the table. I used my right hand to drive his face into the table once, twice, three times. Blood spurted from his nose, and he slid bonelessly across the table to end up on the floor, staring up at the ceiling, gagging, trying to breathe through his injured throat and the smashed nose. I think if he could have breathed better, he'd have passed out, but it's hard to pass out when you're gagging. He rocked on the floor, gagging, eyes rolled back into his head, not focused. I was standing beside the booth, staring down at him. My gun was still in my left hand at my side, unobtrusive against my black jeans. Most people wouldn't even see the gun. They'd see the blood and the man on the floor. Harold and the tall newt were standing there, frozen, staring down at Russell. Harold shook his head sadly.
You shouldn't have done that.
Edward was standing beside the booth, blocking their view of Donna and Becca. He spoke softly, so his voice wouldn't carry much beyond our little circle.
Don't ever threaten these people again, Harold. Don't come near them for any reason. Tell Riker that they are off limits, or the next time it won't just be a broken nose.
I see the guns, Harold said, voice low.
He bent down beside Russell. The big man's eyes still weren't focused. His blue t-shirt had turned purple with blood. Harold was shaking his head. He looked up at me.
Who the hell are you?
Anita Blake, I said.
He shook his head again.
Don't know the name.
I guess my reputation does not precede me, I said.
It will,
Harold said. I said, Peter, get some napkins. Peter didn't ask questions. He just got a double handful of napkins from the dispenser on the table and handed them my way. I took them with my right hand and held them out to Harold. He took them, watching my face, eyes flicking to the gun still bare against my leg.
Thanks.
Don't mention it. He shoved the napkins against Russell's nose and took one arm.
Get his other arm, Newt.
There was a distant wail of sirens coming closer. Someone had called the cops. Russell was still unsteady on his feet. They'd shoved napkins into his flattened nose, and he looked both silly and grotesque with the bloody napkins sticking out of his nose. He had to clear his voice twice before he could speak. His voice sounded rough, clogged, painful.
You fucking bitch. I'm going to hurt you so bad for this.
When you can stand without help, and you've got your nose packed at the nearest emergency room, give me a call. I'd love a rematch. He spat in my general direction but didn't have the aim, so it splattered harmlessly onto the floor. Gross, but not very effective.
Come on,
Harold said. He was trying to move the show towards the door. The sirens were very close now. But Russell wasn't finished. He turned, forcing the other two to turn with him.
I am going to fuck your bitch and leave the girl and boy for the coyotes.
Russell is not a fast learner, I said. Becca was crying now, and Donna was so pale I was worried she was going to faint. I couldn't turn around enough to see Peter's face without turning away from the bad guys, so I don't know what he looked like, but it wasn't a pretty scene. The cops spilled in with Harold still trying to get Russell out the door. Edward and I used the confusion to put up our guns. The two uniforms were a little unsure whom to arrest, but the people actually testified to having heard Russell's threats and seeing him menace us before I heard him. I'd never seen so much witness cooperation. Most of the time people are deaf and dumb, but having a small, pretty little girl in tears helped people's memories. Technically, Russell could press assault charges on me, but everyone was jumping over themselves to say that he'd been threatening us. One man claimed he'd seen Russell pull a knife. Amazing how quickly details are added to a story. I could not corroborate the knife, but I had enough witnesses to the threats that I didn't think I'd be going to jail. Edward pulled out his TED ID, and the officers knew him by reputation if not by sight. I pulled out my executioner's license and my gun carry permit. Technically, I was carrying concealed when my permit wasn't for this state. I explained I'd worn the jacket to keep from distressing the children. The cops nodded, wrote it down, and seemed to accept it all. It helped that Russell was being verbally abusive to the officers and was so obviously a badass, and I was so harmless-looking, so small, so feminine, and so much less scary than he was. Edward gave them his address, said I'd be staying with him, and we were free to go. The restaurant offered us a different table, but strangely, Donna and the kids had lost their appetites. I was still hungry, but no one asked me. Edward paid for the food and declined a takeout order. I put the tip on the blood-stained table, way over-tipping to try and make up for the mess. Then we left, and I still hadn't eaten today. Maybe if I asked nicely, Edward would run through a drive-up window at McDonald's. Any port in a storm. Chapter 14. Donna started crying out in the parking lot. Becca joined her. Only Peter stayed silent and apart from the general hysteria. The more Donna cried, the more panicky the girl got, like they were feeding off each other. The girl was crying in those great hiccupy sobs bordering on hyperventilation. I looked at Edward and raised my eyebrows. He looked blank. I finally gave him a push. He mouthed, "Which one?" "Girl," I mouthed back. He knelt by them. Donna had settled down on the bumper of his Hummer, cradling Becca in her lap. Edward knelt in front of them.
"Let me take Becca for a little walk."
Donna blinked up at him as if she saw him, heard him, but wasn't really understanding. He reached for Becca and started prying her from her mother's arms. Donna's arms were limp, but the girl clung to her mother, screaming. Edward literally pried her small fingers away, and when she was free of her mother, Becca turned and clung to him, burying her face in his shoulder. He looked at me over the girl's head, and I shooed him away. He never questioned, just walked towards the sidewalk that edged the parking lot. He was rocking the girl slowly as he moved, soothing her. Donna had covered her face with her hands, collapsing forward until her face and hands met her knees. Her sobs were full-blown, almost wails. "Shit." I looked at Peter. He was watching her, and the look on his face was disgusted, embarrassed. I knew in that instant that he'd been the adult in more ways than just shooting his father's killer. His mother was allowed hysterics, but he wasn't. He was the one who held together in a crisis. Damned unfair, if you ask me. "Peter, can you excuse us for a few minutes?" He shook his head.
"No."
I sighed, then shrugged. "Fine. Just don't interfere." I knelt in front of Donna, touching her shaking shoulders. "Donna! Donna!" There was no response, no change. It had been a long day. I got a handful of that short, thick hair and pulled her head up. It hurt, and it was meant to. "Look at me, you selfish bitch." Peter moved forward, and I pointed a finger at him. "Don't." He settled back a step, but he didn't leave. His face was angry, watchful, and I knew that he might interfere regardless of what I said if I went much further. But I didn't have to go further. I'd shocked her. Her eyes were wide, inches from mine, her face drenched with tears. Her breathing was still coming in small, chest-heaving gulps, but she was looking at me. She was listening. I released her hair slowly, and she stayed staring at me with a horrible fascination on her face, as if I were about to do something cruel. And I was. "Your little girl has just seen the worst thing she's ever seen in her life. She was calming down, taking it in stride, until you started on the hysterics. You're her mother. You're her strength, her protector. When she saw you fall apart like that, it terrified her."
"I didn't mean... I couldn't help..."
"I don't give a shit what you feel or how upset you are. You're the mommy. She's the child. You are going to hold yourself together until she is not around to see you fall apart. Is that clear?" She blinked at me.
"I don't know if I can do that."
"You can do it. You're going to do it." I glanced up but didn't see Edward yet. "Good. You are the grown-up, Donna, and you are by God going to act like it." I could feel Peter watching us, could almost feel him storing it away for later playback. He would remember this little scene and he would think on it, You could feel it.
Do you have children?
She asked, and I knew what was coming. No, I said.
Then what right do you have to tell me how to raise mine?
She was angry now, sitting up straighter, wiping at her face with short, harsh movements. Sitting up on the bumper, she was taller than I was kneeling. I looked up into her angry eyes and told the truth. I was 8 years old when my mother died, and my father couldn't handle it. We got a phone call from a state trooper that told us she was dead. My father dropped the phone and started to wail. Not cry, wail. He took me by the hand and walked the few blocks to my grandmother's house, wailing, leading me by the hand. By the time we got to my grandmother's, we had a crowd of neighbors, all asking what was wrong, what was wrong. I was the one who turned to my neighbors and said, "My mommy's dead." My father was collapsed in the bosom of his family, and I was left standing alone, uncomforted, unheld, tears on my face, telling the neighbors what had happened. Donna stared at me, and there was something very close to horror on her face.
"I'm sorry,"
she said in a voice that had grown soft and lost its anger. "Don't be sorry for me, Donna, but be a mother to your own daughter. Hold it together. She needs you to comfort her right now. Later, when you're alone or with Ted, you can fall apart, but please, not in front of the kids. That goes for Peter, too." She glanced at him, standing there watching us, and she flushed, embarrassed at last. She nodded her head too rapidly, then visibly straightened. You could actually see her gathering herself. She took my hands, squeezing them. "I am sorry for your loss, and I apologize for today. I'm not very good around violence. If it's an accident, a cut, no matter the blood, I'm fine, honestly, but I just can't abide violence."
I took my hands gently from hers. I wasn't sure I believed her, but I said, "I'm glad to know that, Donna. I'll go get Ted and Becca." She nodded.
"Thank you."
I stood, nodding. I walked across the gravel in the direction Edward had gone. I liked Donna less now, but I knew now that Edward had to get away from this family. Donna wasn't good around violence. Jesus, if she only knew who, what, she'd taken to her bed. She'd have had hysterics for the rest of her life.
Edward had walked down the sidewalk to stand in front of one of the many small houses. They all had gardens in front, well-tended, well-planned. It reminded me of California, where every inch of yard is used for something because land is at such a premium. Albuquerque didn't look nearly as crowded, and yet the yards were crowded. Edward was still holding Becca, but she was looking at something that he was pointing at, and there was a smile on her face that showed from two houses away. A tension I hadn't realized I was carrying eased from my back and shoulders. When she turned so that her face was full to me, I saw a sprig of lilac tucked into one of her braids. The pale lavender flower didn't match the yellow ribbons and dress, but hey, it was cute as hell. Her smile faltered around the edges when she saw me. There was a very good chance that I wouldn't be one of Becca's favorite people. I'd probably scared her. Oh, well. Edward put her down, and they walked towards me. She was smiling up at him, swinging his arm a little. He smiled down at her, and it looked real. Even to me it looked real. You might have really believed he was Becca's adored and adoring father. How the hell were we going to get him out of their lives without screwing Becca over? Peter would be pleased if Ted went poof, and Donna, she was a grown-up. Becca wasn't. Shit. Edward smiled at me and said in his cheerful Ted voice,
"How are things?"
"Just dandy," I said. He raised eyebrows, and for a split second his eyes flinched, going from cynical to cheerful so fast it made me dizzy. "Donna and Peter are waiting for us." Edward turned so that the girl was between us. She glanced up at me, and her gaze was questioning, thoughtful.
"You beat up that bad man,"
she said. "Yes, I did," I said.
"I didn't know girls could do that."
That made my teeth hurt. Girls can do anything they want to do, including protect themselves and beat up bad guys.
"Ted said that you hurt that man because he said bad things to me."
I glanced at Edward, but his face was all open and cheerful for the child and gave me nothing. "That's right," I said.
"Ted says that you'd hurt someone to protect me just like he would."
I met her big brown eyes and nodded. "Yes, I would." She smiled then, and it was beautiful, like sunshine breaking through clouds. She reached out her free hand to me, and I took it. Edward and I walked back to the parking lot, holding the child's hands while she half-walked, half-danced between us. She believed in Ted,
And Ted had told her that she could believe in me, so she did. The odd thing was that I would hurt someone to protect her. I would kill to keep her safe. I looked across at Edward, and for just a moment he looked back at me from the mask. We stared at each other over the child, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to get us all out of the mess that he had made. Becca said,
"Swing me."
Edward counted out, 1, 2, 3, and swung her up and out, forcing me to swing her other arm. We moved across the parking lot, swinging Becca between us while she gave that joyous, full-throated laugh. We sat her down laughing in front of her mother. Donna was composed and smiling. I was proud of her. Becca looked up at me, shining.
Mommy says I'm too big to swing now, but you're strong, aren't you?
I smiled at her, but I looked at Edward when I said, "Yes, I am." Chapter 15. Donna and Edward did a tender but decorous goodbye. Peter rolled his eyes and scowled as if they'd done a lot more than a semi-chaste kiss. He'd have had a cow if he could have seen them smooching earlier at the airport. Becca kissed Edward on the cheek, giggling. Peter ignored it all and got in the car as soon as he could, as if afraid Ted might try to hug him, too. Edward waved until the car turned onto Lomos and out of sight. Then he turned to me. All he did was look at me, but it was enough. "Let's get in the car and get some air conditioning going before I grill you about what the hell is going on," I said. He unlocked the car. We got inside. He started the engine and the air conditioner, though the air hadn't had time to cool yet. We sat in the expensive hum of his engine with the hot air blowing on us, and silence filled the car.
"Are you counting to 10?
He asked. "Try 1,000 and you'll be closer."
"Ask. I know you want to."
"Okay. We'll skip the tirade about you dragging Donna and her kids into your mess and go straight to who the hell is Riker and why did he send goons to warn you off?"
"First, it was Donna's mess, and she dragged me into it."
My disbelief must have shown on my face because he continued,
"She and her friends are part of an amateur archaeology society that tries to preserve Native American sites in the area. Are you familiar with how an archaeological dig is done?"
"A little. I know they use string and tags to mark where an object is found, take pictures, make drawings, sort of like you do for a dead body before you move it."
"Trust you to come up with the perfect analogy," he said, but he was smiling. "I've gone with Donna on weekends with the kids. They use frickin' toothbrushes and tiny paintbrushes to gently clean the dirt away, or dental picks."
"I know you have a point," I said.
"Pot hunters find a site that is already being explored, or sometimes one that hasn't been found, and they bring in bulldozers and backhoes to take out as much as possible in the least amount of time."
I gaped at him. "But that destroys more than they can possibly take out. And if you move an object before its site is recorded, it loses a lot of its historical value. I mean, the dirt it's found in can help date it. What is found near an object can tell all sorts of things to a trained eye."
"Pot hunters don't care about history. They take what they find and sell it to private collectors or dealers who aren't too particular about how an object was found. A site that Donna was volunteering on was raided."
"She asked you to look into it," I said.
"You underestimate her. She and her psychic friends thought they could reason with Riker, since they were pretty sure it was his people behind it."
I sighed. "I don't underestimate her, Edward."
"She and her friends didn't understand what a bad man Riker is. Some of the really big pod hunters hire bodyguards, goon squads, to help take care of the bleeding hearts and even the local law. Riker is suspected of having been behind the deaths of 2 local cops. It's one of the reasons that things went so smoothly in the restaurant. All the local cops know that Riker's a suspected cop killer, not personally, but of hiring it done."
I smiled, not a pleasant smile. I wonder how many traffic tickets he and his men have acquired since it happened.
"Enough that his lawyer filed a harassment suit. There is no proof that Riker's people were involved, just the fact that the cops were killed at a dig that had been partially bulldozed, and an eyewitness that saw a car with a partial plate that might have been one of his trucks."
"Is the witness still among the living?" I asked.
"My, you do catch on quick."
"I take it that's a no."
"He's missing,"
Edward said. "So why come after Donna and her kids?"
"Because the kids were with her when she and her group formed a protest line protecting a site that was on private land that Riker had gotten permission to bulldoze. She was their spokesperson."
"Stupid. She should not have taken the kids."
"Like I said, Donna didn't understand how bad a man Riker was."
"And what happened?"
"Her group was manhandled, abused, beaten. They fled. Donna had a black eye.
And what did Ted do about this? I was watching his face, arms crossed over my stomach. All I could see was his profile, but it was enough. He hadn't liked it that Donna had gotten hurt. Maybe it was just that she belonged to him, a male pride thing, or maybe it was more.
Donna asked me to have a talk with the men.
I take it that would be the two men that you put in the hospital. I seem to remember you asking Harold if two guys were still in the hospital. Edward nodded.
Yeah.
Only two in the hospital and none in a grave. You must be slipping.
I couldn't kill anyone without Donna knowing, so I made an example of two of his men.
Let me guess. One of them would be the man who gave Donna the black eye. Edward smiled happily.
Tom.
And the other one?
He pushed Peter and threatened to break his arm.
I shook my head. The air had begun to cool, and it raised goosebumps even through my jacket. Or maybe it wasn't the cold. The second guy has a broken arm now?
Among other things, Edward said.
Edward, look at me. He turned and gave me his cool blue gaze. Truth, do you care for this family? Would you kill to protect them?
I'd kill to amuse myself, Anita.
I shook my head and leaned close to him, close enough to study his face, to try and make him give up his secrets. No jokes, Edward. Tell me the truth. Are you serious about Donna?
You asked me if I loved her, and I said no.
I shook my head again. Damn it, don't keep evading the answer. I don't think you do love her. I don't think you're capable of it, but you feel something. I don't know exactly what, but something. Do you feel something for this family? For all of them? His face was blank, and I couldn't read it. He just stared at me. I wanted to slap him, to scream and rant until I broke through his mask into whatever lay underneath. I'd always been on sure ground with Edward, always known where he stood, even when he was planning to hurt me. But now, suddenly, I wasn't sure about anything. My God, you do care for them. I slumped back in my seat, weak. I couldn't have been more astonished if he'd sprouted a second head. That would have been weird. But not this weird. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Edward. You care for them. All of them. He looked away. Edward, the stone-cold killer, looked away. He couldn't or wouldn't meet my gaze. He put the car in gear and forced me to buckle my seatbelt. I let him pull out of the parking lot in silence, but when we were sitting at the stop sign waiting for the traffic to clear on Lomos, I had to say something. What are you going to do?
I don't know, he said. I don't love Donna.
But, I said. He turned slowly onto the main street.
She's a mess. She believes in every New Age bandwagon that comes along. She's got a good head for business, but she trusts everyone. She's useless around violence. You saw her today.
He was concentrating very hard on the driving, hands gripping the wheel tight enough for his knuckles to be white.
Becca is just like her. Trusting, sweet, but tougher, I think. Both the kids are tougher than Donna.
They've had to be, I said, and couldn't keep the disapproval out of my voice.
I know,
he said.
I know Donna. Everything about her. I've heard every detail from cradle to the present.
Did it bore you? I asked.
Some of it,
he said carefully. But not all of it, I said.
No, not all of it.
Are you saying that you do love Donna? I had to ask.
No, I am not saying that.
I was staring so hard at his face that we could have been driving on the far side of the moon for all the attention I gave the scenery. Nothing mattered more right that second than Edward's face, his voice. Then what are you saying?
I'm saying that sometimes when you play a part too long, you can get sucked into that part and it becomes more real than it was meant to be.
I saw something on his face that I had never seen before. Anguish. Uncertainty. Are you saying that you are going to marry Donna? You're going to be a husband and a father? PTA meetings and the whole nine yards?
No, I'm not saying that. You know I can't marry her. I can't live with her and two kids and hide what I am 24 hours a day. That good an actor I'm not.
Then what are you saying? I asked.
I'm saying that part of me, a small part of me, wishes I could.
I stared at him open-mouthed. Edward, assassin extraordinaire, the undead's perfect predator, wished he could have not a family, but this family. A trusting new age widow, her sullen teenage son, and a little girl that made Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm look jaded. And Edward wanted them. When I trusted myself to be coherent, I said, "What are you going to do?"
"I don't know."
I couldn't think of anything helpful to say, so I resorted to humor, my shield of last resort. "Just please tell me they don't have a dog and a picket fence." He smiled.
"No fence, but a dog. Two dogs."
"What kind of dogs?" I asked. He smiled and glanced at me, wanting to see my reaction.
"Maltese. Their names are Pika and Boo."
"Oh, shit, Edward, you're joking me."
"Donna wants the dogs included in the engagement pictures."
I stared at him, and the look on my face seemed to amuse him. He laughed.
"I'm glad you're here, Anita, because I don't know a single other person who I'd have admitted this to."
"Do you realize that your personal life is now more complicated than mine is?" I said.
"Now I know I'm in trouble," he said.
And we left it on a lighter note, on a joke, because we were more comfortable that way. But Edward had confided in me about a personal problem. In his way, he'd come to me for help about it. And being who I was, I'd try to help him. I thought we would solve the mutilations and murders eventually. I mean, violence and death were our specialties. I was not nearly so optimistic about the personal stuff. Edward did not belong in a world with a woman who had a pair of toy dogs named Pika and Boo. Edward was not now, nor ever would be, that cutesy. Donna was. It wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work. But for the very first time, I realized that if Edward didn't have a heart to lose, that he wished he had one to give. But I was reminded of the scene in The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy and the Scarecrow bang on the Tin Man's chest and hear the rolling echo. The tinsmith had forgotten to put in a heart. Edward had carved his own heart out of his body and left it on a floor somewhere years ago. I'd known that. I just never knew that Edward regretted the loss. And I think until Donna Parnell came along, he hadn't known it either. Chapter 16. Edward did take me through a drive-up window, but he didn't want to stop. He seemed anxious to get to Santa Fe. Since he was rarely anxious about anything, I didn't argue. I requested we go through a car wash while I ate my French fries and cheeseburger. He didn't say a word, just drove into one beside the highway that let us ride through in the car. When I was little, I'd loved watching the suds slide down the window and the huge brushes roll by. It was still nifty, though not the thrill a minute it had been when I was 5. But the car wash did mean that I had a clear view out all the windows. The dirty windows had made me feel ever so slightly claustrophobic. I'd finished my food before we left Albuquerque. I sipped on my soda as we drove out of town and towards the mountains. These were not the Black Mountains, but a different range that looked more normal. They were jagged and rocky-looking, with a string of glittering light near their base. "What's with the light show?" I asked.
"What?"
Edward asked. "The glitter. What is it?" I felt his attention shift from the road, but he was wearing his sunglasses, and I couldn't really see his gaze shift.
"Houses. The sun is hitting the windows on the houses."
"I've never seen sunlight on windows glitter like that."
"Albuquerque is at 7,000 feet. The air is thinner than you're used to. It makes light do strange things."
I stared at the sparkling windows like a line of jewels embedded in the mountains. "It's beautiful." He moved his whole head this time, so I knew he was really looking at it.
"If you say so."
After that, we stopped talking. Edward never did idle chatter, and apparently he had nothing to say. My mind was still reeling from Edward being in love, or as close as he would probably ever get. It was just too weird. I couldn't think of a single useful thing to say, so I stared out the window until I thought of something worth saying. I had a feeling it was going to be a long, quiet drive to Santa Fe. The hills were very round, covered in dry, brownish grass. I had the same feeling I'd had when I stepped off the plane in Albuquerque. Desolate. I'd thought the hills were close until I spotted a cow standing on one. The cow looked tiny, small enough for me to cover with two fingers held up, which meant the hills were really small mountains and not nearly as close to the road as they appeared. It was late afternoon or early evening, depending on how you looked at it. It was still daylight, but you could feel night looming even in the brightness. The day had worn away like a piece of candy sucked too long. No matter how bright the sunshine, I could feel the darkness pressing close. Partly it was my mood. Confusion always makes me pessimistic. But it was also an innate sense of the coming night. I was a vampire executioner, and I knew the taste of night on the breeze just as I knew the feel of dawn pressing against the darkness. There had been times when my life had depended on dawn coming. Nothing like near-death experiences to hone a skill. The sunlight had begun to fade to a soft evening gloom when I'd finally had enough of the silence. I still had nothing helpful to say about his personal life, but there was the case. I'd been asked here to help solve a crime, not to play Dear Abby, so maybe if I just concentrated on the crime, we'd be okay. Is there anything about the cases that you've withheld from me? Anything I'm going to be pissed that I didn't know beforehand?
Changing the subject? He asked.
I wasn't aware we were on a subject, I said.
You know what I meant.
I sighed. Yeah, I know what you meant. I slumped in my seat as far as the seatbelt would allow, arms crossed over my stomach. My body language was not happy, nor was I. I don't have anything to add to the Donna situation, or nothing helpful.
So concentrate on business, he said.
You taught me that, I said. You and Dolph. Keep your eye and mind on the important stuff. The important stuff is what can get you killed. Donna and her kitties aren't a threat to life and limb, so put them on the back burner. He smiled, his normal close-lipped, I-know-something-you-don't-know smile. It didn't always mean he knew something I didn't. Sometimes he did it just to irritate. Like now.
I thought you said you'd kill me if I didn't stop dating Donna.
I rubbed my neck against the expensive seats and tried to ease a tension that was beginning at the base of my skull. Maybe I had been invited here to play Dear Abby, at least in part. Shit. You were right, Edward. You can't just leave. It would screw up Becca for one thing. But you cannot keep dating Donna indefinitely. She's going to start asking for a date for the wedding. And what are you going to say?
I don't know, he said.
Well, neither do I, so let's talk about the case.
At least with that, we've got a solid direction.
We do?
He glanced at me as he asked. We know we want the mutilations and murders to stop, right? I asked.
Yes, he said.
Well, that's more than we know about Donna.
Are you saying you don't want me to stop seeing her?
He asked, and that damn smile was back.
Smug. He looked smug.
I'm saying I don't know what the hell I want you to do, let alone what you should do, so let's leave it alone until I get some brilliant idea.
Okay, he said.
Great, I said. Now back to the question I asked. What haven't you told me about the crimes that you think I should know, or rather, that I think I should know?
I don't read minds, Anita. I don't know what you'll want to know.
Don't be coy, Edward. Just spill the beans. I don't want any more surprises on this trip. Not from you. He was quiet for so long I thought he wasn't going to answer. So I prompted him. Edward, I mean it.
I'm thinking, he said.
He moved in his seat, shoulders tightening and loosening as if he were trying to get rid of tension, too. I guess even for him this had been a stressful day. Odd to think of Edward letting anything truly stress him. I'd always thought he walked through life with the perfect zen of the sociopath so that nothing truly bothered him. I'd been wrong. Wrong about a lot of things. I went back to watching the scenery. There were cows scattered close enough to the road that you could make out color and size. If it wasn't a Jersey, a Guernsey, or a Black Angus, I didn't know it. I watched the strange cows standing at impossible angles on the steep hillsides and waited for Edward to finish thinking. Twilight seemed to last a long time here, as if the light of day gave up the fight slowly, struggling to remain and keep the darkness at bay. Maybe it was just my mood, but I wasn't looking forward to darkness. It was as if I could sense something out there in those desolate hills, something waiting for the night, something that could not move during the day. It could just be my own overactive imagination, or I could be right. That was the hard part about psychic abilities. Sometimes you were right, and sometimes you weren't. Sometimes your own anxiety or fear could poison your thinking and make you almost literally see ghosts where there were none. There were, of course, ways to find out. Is there a place where you can pull over out of sight of the main road? He looked at me.
Why?
I'm sensing something, and I just want to make sure I'm not imagining it. He didn't argue. When the next exit came up, he took it. We took a side road from the exit. It was dirt and gravel and full of huge, dry potholes. The shocks on his Hummer took the road like silk flowing downhill, comfy. A soft roll of hills hid us from the main highway, but the road was very flat in front of us, giving a clear view of the road as it went almost straight towards a distant rise of hills. There were a handful of tiny houses on either side of the road, the major cluster some ways ahead with a small church sitting to one side by itself, as if it were part of the houses, and not. The church had a steeple with a cross on top of it, and I assumed a bell inside of it, though we were too far away to be sure. The town, if it were a town, looked down on its luck, but not empty. There were people there, and eyes to see us. Just our luck. The land had been so empty, and the road we go down has a town. "Stop the car," I said. We were as far from the first house as we could get without backtracking. Edward pulled over to the side of the road. The dust rose in a cloud to either side of the car, settling over the clean paint job in a dry powder. "You guys don't get much rain up here, do you?"
"No,"
he said. Anyone else would have elaborated, but not Edward. Even the weather wasn't a topic of conversation unless it affected the job. I got out of the car and walked a little way into the dry grass. I walked until I could no longer sense Edward or the car. When I looked back, I was yards away. Edward was standing on the driver's side door, arms crossed on the roof, hat tilted back so he could watch the show. I don't think there was another person I knew who wouldn't have asked at least one question about what I was about to do. It would be interesting to see if he asked any questions afterwards. Darkness hung like a soft silken cloth, hanging against the sky and the dying light. It was a soft, comfortable twilight, an embracing dark. A breeze blew across the open land and played with my hair. Everything felt fine. Good. Had I imagined? Was I letting Edward's problems get to me? Was the memory of the survivors in their air-compressed hospital room making me see shadows? I almost just turned around and walked back to the car, but I didn't. If it were my imagination, then it wouldn't hurt to check, and if it wasn't... I turned and faced away from the car, away from the distant houses, and looked out into the emptiness. Of course, it wasn't really empty. There was grass rustling in the wind. It sounded so dry, like corn in autumn just before it's harvested. The ground was covered in a thin layer of pale reddish-brown gravel, with paler dirt showing through. The ground ran until it met the hills that continued on and on towards the darkening sky. Not empty, just lonely. I took a deep cleansing breath, let it out, and did two things at once. I dropped my shields and spread my arms wide, hands reaching. I was reaching with my hands, but it wasn't just my hands. I reached outward with that sense I have. Magic, if you like the word. I don't. I reached outward with that power that let me raise the dead and mix with werewolves. I reached outward towards that waiting presence that I'd felt, or thought I'd felt. There. There, like a fish tugging on my line. I turned to face the direction of the road. It was in that direction, going towards Santa Fe. It. I had no better word. I felt its eagerness for the coming night, and knew that it could not move in daylight. And I knew that it was large, not physically, but psychically, because we were not close to it, and yet I picked it up miles away. How many miles, I couldn't say, but far, very far to have sensed it. It didn't feel evil. That didn't mean it wasn't evil, just that it didn't think of itself as evil. Unlike people, preternatural entities are rather proud of being evil. They embraced their malignancy because whatever this was, it wasn't human. It wasn't physical. Spirit, energy, pick a word, but it was up ahead, and it was not contained in any physical shell. It was free-floating. No. Not free. Something slammed into me, not physically, but as if a psychic truck had run me down. I was on my butt in the dirt, trying to breathe as if someone had hit me in the chest and knocked the wind out of me. I heard Edward's running footsteps, but I couldn't seem to turn around. I was too busy relearning how to breathe. He knelt by me, gun in hand.
What happened?
He was looking out into the thick twilight, not at me, searching, searching for the danger. His sunglasses were gone, and his face was very serious as he searched for something to shoot. I gripped his arm, shaking my head, trying to talk. But when I finally had air enough, all I said was shit, shit, shit. It wasn't helpful, but I was scared. Most of the time when I get this scared, I get cold, shocky, but not when it's psychic shit. When something goes wrong with magic, I never go shocky or get cold. I stay warm. If anything, it's like tingling, warm, as if I'd stuck my finger in a light socket. Whatever it was had sensed me and shut me down. I pulled my shields around me like clutching a coat against a blizzard, but strangely it had backed off. Though if that one swat of power was any indication, it could slice me, dice me, and serve me on toast if it wanted to. It hadn't wanted to. I was glad, thrilled, but why hadn't it hurt me worse? How had I sensed it from so far away, and how had it sensed me? Usually my greatest talent is with the dead. Did that mean whatever it was dead, or had something to do with the dead? Or was this one of the new psychic abilities that my teacher, Marianne, had warned me might crop up? God, I hope not. I didn't need more strange shit in my life. I had plenty. I forced myself to stop the useless cursing and said, "Put up the gun, Edward, I'm all right. Besides, there's nothing to shoot and nothing to see." He put a hand under my arm and pulled me to my feet before I was ready. I'd have been very happy to stay sitting for a while. I leaned on him, and he started moving us back towards the car. I stumbled and finally had to tell him, "Stop, please." He held me up, still searching the new dark, gun still in hand. I should have known he'd keep the gun out. It was his security blanket. Sometimes. I could breathe again, and if Edward stopped dragging me on, I might be able to walk. The fear had faded because it was useless. I'd tried a bit of magic, and I hadn't been good enough. I was learning ritual magic, but I was a beginner. Power isn't enough. You've got to know what to do with it, like a gun with the safety on. It makes a fine paperweight, but that's about it unless you know what to do with it. I slid into the car, had my door closed and locked before Edward opened his door.
"Tell me what happened, Anita."
I looked at him. It would serve you right if I just looked at you and smiled. Something crossed his face, a frown, a snarl, quickly lost to that perfect blankness he could manage.
"You're right. I've been a secret-loving bastard, and it would serve me right. But you're the one who said we needed to stop the pissing contest and solve the crime. I'll stop if you will."
I nodded.
"Agreed."
"So?" he said. "Start the car and get us out of here." Somehow I didn't like sitting on the nearly deserted road in the freshly spilled darkness. I wanted to be moving. Sometimes movement gives you the illusion that you're doing something. Edward started the car, turned around in the weeds, and drove back towards the highway.
"Talk.
I've never been to this area before. For all I know, what I sensed is always here, just some local bugaboo."
"What did you sense?"
"Something powerful. Something that's miles away towards Santa Fe. Something that may be connected to the dead in some way, which would explain why it called to me so strongly. I'm going to need to find a good local psychic to see if this thing is always around or not."
"Donna will know some psychics. Whether they're good, I can't say, and I'm not sure she can either."
"It's a place to start," I said. I snuggled into my seatbelt, hugging myself. "You got any local animators, necromancers, anyone who works with the dead? If it is something connected to my type of power, then an ordinary psychic might not sense it."
"I don't know of any, but I'll ask around."
"Good." We were back out on the highway. The night was very dark, as if thick clouds hid the sky. The headlights seemed very yellow against the blackness.
"Do you think this whatever it is has anything to do with the mutilations?"
he asked. "I don't know."
"You don't know a hell of a lot,"
he said. He sounded grumpy. "That's the problem with psychic shit and magic. Sometimes it's not very helpful."
"I've never seen you do anything like what you just did. You hate the mystical crap."
"Yes, I do, but I've had to accept what I am, Edward. This mystical crap is a part of who and what I am. I can't run from it because it is me. You can't hide from yourself, not forever, and you can't ever outrun yourself. I raise the dead for a living, Edward. Why should it be a shock that I may have other abilities?"
"It's not," he said.
I glanced at him, but he was watching the road, and I couldn't read his face.
"It's not,"
I said.
"I called you in to be backup not just because you're a shooter, but because you know more about preternatural stuff than anyone else I know that I trust. You hate the psychics and the mediums because you are one, but you still deal in reality, and that makes you different from the rest of them."
"You're wrong, Edward. I saw a soul today hovering in that room. It was real, just as real as the gun in your holster. Psychics, witches, mediums, they all deal in reality. It's just not the same reality that you deal with. But it is real, Edward. It is very, very real." He didn't say anything to that, just let the silence fill the car. And I was content with silence because I was tired, terribly, terribly tired. I'd found that doing psychic shit sometimes exhausted me a hell of a lot faster than physical labor. I ran 4 miles every other day, lifted weights, took Kempo class and judo, and none of it made me as tired as having stood in that field and opened myself to that thing. I never sleep in a car because I don't trust the driver not to have a wreck and kill me. That is the truth about why I don't sleep in cars, no matter what I say out loud. My mother was killed in a car accident, and I've never really trusted cars since. I settled down in my seat, trying to find a comfortable place for my head. I was suddenly so tired my eyes burned. I closed my eyes just to rest them, and sleep dragged at me like a hand pulling me under. I could have fought it, but I didn't. I needed the rest, and I needed it now, or I wouldn't be worth shit soon. And the thought crossed my mind as I let myself relax that I did trust Edward. I really did. I slept huddled in the seat and didn't wake until the car stopped.
"We're here," Edward said.
I struggled to sit up, feeling stiff but rested.
"Where?" "Ted's house."
I sat up straighter.
"Ted's house?"
"Edward's house. I was finally going to get to see where Edward lived. I was going to snoop and strip some of his mystery away. If I didn't get killed, finding out Edward's secrets would make the entire trip worthwhile. If I did get killed, I'd come back and haunt Edward. See if I could make him see ghosts after all. Chapter 17. The house was adobe and looked old or genuine. Not that I was an expert, but there was a feel to the house of age. We unloaded my luggage from the back of the Hummer, but I had eyes mostly for the house. Edward's house. I'd never really hoped to see where he lived. He was like Batman. He rode into town, saved your ass, then vanished, and you never really expected an invitation to see the Batcave. Now here I was, standing in front of it. Cool. It wasn't what I'd pictured. I'd thought maybe a high-tech condo in the city, L.A. maybe. This modest-appearing adobe house hugging the land was just not what I'd had in mind. It was part of his secret identity, his Tedness, but still, Edward lived here, and there had to be more reason than just Ted would have liked it. I was beginning to think I really didn't know Edward at all. The light over the front door switched on, and I had to turn away, shielding my night vision. I'd been staring right at it when it glared to life. I had two thoughts. One, who had turned on the light? Two, the door was blue. The door was painted a blue-violet, a rich, rich color. I could also see the window nearest the door. Its trim was painted the same vibrant blue. I'd seen it at the airport, though with more flowers and an addition of fuchsia. I asked, "What's with the blue door and trim?"
"Maybe I like it," he said.
"I've seen a lot of doors painted blue or turquoise on a lot of houses since I've been here. What gives?"
"Very observant."
"A failing of mine. Now explain."
"They think witches can't cross a door painted blue or green."
I widened my eyes. "You believe that?"
"I doubt most of the people who paint their doors believe it anymore, but it's become part of the local style. My guess is that most people who do it don't even remember the folklore behind it."
"Like putting out a jack-o'-lantern at Halloween to frighten the goblins away," I said.
"Exactly."
"And because I am so observant, who turned on the porch light?"
"Either Bernardo or Olaf."
"Your other backups," I said.
"Yes."
"Can't wait to meet them."
"In the spirit of cooperation and no more surprises, Olaf doesn't like women much."
"You mean he's gay?"
"No, and implying that to him will probably mean a fight, so please don't. If I'd known I'd be calling you in, I wouldn't have called him in at all. The two of you in the same house on the same case is going to be a fucking disaster."
"That's harsh. You think we can't play nice together?"
"I'd almost guarantee it," he said.
The door opened, and our conversation cut off abruptly. I was wondering if it was the dreaded Olaf. The man in the doorway didn't look much like an Olaf, but then, what does an Olaf look like? The man was 6 foot, give or take an inch. It was hard to tell his exact height because his lower body was completely covered by a white sheet that he had clutched in one hand at his waist. The sheet spilled around his feet like a formal dress, but from the waist up he was anything but formal. He was lean and muscular with a very nice set of abs. He was tanned a lovely even brown, though some of that was natural color because he was American Indian. Oh, yes, he was. His hair was waist length, falling over one shoulder and across the side of his face, heavy and solid black, tousled from sleep, though it was early to be in bed. His face was a soft, full triangle, with a dimple in his chin and a full mouth. Was it racist to say that his features were more white than Indian, or was it just true?
"You can close your mouth now," Edward said near my ear.
I closed my mouth. "Sorry," I mumbled. How embarrassing. I didn't usually notice men this much, at least men I didn't know.
What was wrong with me today?
The man folded the sheet over his free arm until his legs showed, and he could come down the two steps without tripping.
Sorry, I was asleep, or I'd have come out to help sooner.
He seemed perfectly at ease in his sheet, though he was going to a lot of effort to spill it over the same arm that was holding it in place, so he could grab a suitcase.
Bernardo Spotted Horse, Anita Blake.
He was holding the sheet with his right hand, and he looked mildly perplexed as he dropped the suitcase and started the process of switching everything to the other hand. The sheet slipped down in front, and I had to turn my head away fast. I kept my head turned because I was blushing and wanted the darkness to hide it. I waved my hand vaguely behind me. We'll shake hands later when you're wearing clothes. Edward's voice.
You flashed her.
Great, everybody noticed.
I'm sorry, Bernardo said. Truly.
We can get the luggage, I said. Go get a robe. I felt someone move up behind me, and I wasn't sure how I knew, but I knew it wasn't Edward.
You're modest. I expected a lot of things from Edward's descriptions, but not modesty.
I turned around slowly, and he was standing too close, invading the hell out of my personal space. I glared at him. What were you expecting? The Whore of Babylon? I was embarrassed and uncomfortable, and that always made me angry. The anger showed in my voice. The half-smile on his face faded round the edges.
I didn't mean any offense.
His hand came up as he said it, as if he'd touch my hair. I stepped back out of reach. What's with the touchy-feely routine?
I saw the way you looked at me in the doorway, he said.
I felt the heat ride up my face, but I didn't turn away this time. If you want to come to the door looking like a playgirl centerfold, don't blame me for staring. But don't make more of it than it is. You're nice eye candy, but the fact that you're coming on this strong isn't flattering to either of us. Either you're a whore, or you think I am. The first I'm willing to believe. The second I know isn't true. I walked up to him now, invading his space, the blush gone, leaving me pale and angry. So back off. It was his turn to look uncertain. He stepped back, put the sheet into as much of a cover as it could be, and bowed. It was an old-fashioned, courtly move, as if he'd done it before and meant it. It was a nice gesture with his hair spilling all around, but I'd seen better. Not for 6 months, but I had seen better. He raised up, and his face was solemn. He looked sincere.
There are two kinds of women that hang around with men like Edward, like me, that know what we are. The first are whores, no matter how many guns they own. The second is strictly business. I call them Madonnas, because they never sleep with anyone. They try to be one of the guys.
The smile played along his lips again.
Forgive me if I'm disappointed that you're one of the guys. I've been here for 2 weeks, and I'm getting lonely.
I shook my head. 2 weeks. Poor baby. I pushed past him and grabbed my overnight case. I looked at Edward. Next time, remind me about everybody's little foibles. He raised his hand in a Boy Scout oath. I have never seen Bernardo do that with any woman at first meeting her. I swear it. My eyes narrowed, but I looked into his eyes and believed him. How did I get the honor? He picked up my suitcase and did smile. You should have seen the look on your face when he came down the steps in the sheet. He laughed, and it was very masculine.
I've never seen you that embarrassed.
Bernardo came up next to us.
I really, honestly, didn't mean to flash you. I just don't wear anything to bed, so I threw this on.
Where's Olaf? Edward asked.
Pouting that you're bringing her in?
Great, I said. One of you thinks he's a Lothario, and the other one won't talk to me. That's just perfect. I turned and followed Edward toward the house. Bernardo called from behind us.
Don't mistake Olaf, Anita. He likes women in his bed, and he's not nearly as particular as I am about how he gets them there. I'd be more careful of him than of me.
Edward, I said. He was just inside the door. He turned back and looked at me. Is Bernardo right? Is Olaf dangerous to me?
I can tell him about you what I told him about Donna.
What's that? I asked. We were all still in the doorway, not quite in the house.
I told him if he touched her, I'd kill him.
If you come to my rescue, then he'll never work with me, never respect me, I said. Edward nodded.
That's true.
I sighed. I'll handle it on my own. Bernardo had moved up behind me, closer than I wanted him. I used the carry-on bag to accidentally move him back a step or two.
Olaf has been in prison for rape.
I looked at Edward and let my disbelief show on my face. Is he serious? Edward just nodded. His face had gone to its usual blankness.
I told you in the car that I wouldn't have invited him if I'd known you were coming in on this.
But you didn't mention the rape conviction, I said.
He shrugged. I should have.
What else should I know about good old Olaf?